Mr. Dyers,
Mm.
as you know, we've recently initiated an eminent scholars archive, and the first person we spoke to was Professor Lipstein. This opened up some very interesting reminiscences, and if I may say so, there are some similarities with your situation. You both arrived in Cambridge before the Second World War, and in addition to seeing the department go through the trauma of war, you both had to adapt to a new way of life in a strange country. You've been associated with the Faculty of Law and the Library for almost 70 years, but I'd like to start before that with your early life in Ceylon. So could you give me some recollections of your early days, for example, where you grew up, your family, your home, your education, and were you exposed to law at an early age?
Yes, well, I was born in 1921, and until the age of 18, I lived in Ceylon, in Colombo. My family was very legal. My grandfather was a judge of the Supreme Court, and my father was a judge of the Supreme Court, so it was inevitable that I should follow suit.
I wondered about that, whether your family had been legal.
Oh, yes, they had been, yes. And during that period, I know one thing my father did, and that was to have me as his amanuensis while he was hearing cases. And that was very interesting indeed. So I used to sit on the bench beside him and at his dictation record the evidence.
You would record the evidence.
Mm.
Fascinating. So at what age were you?
Oh, teens.
Oh, that must have been wonderful.
That was great, yes.
Yes.
It was very interesting to hear the case being thrashed out in court between counsel and all the rest of it.
Absolutely.
Mm.
So did you get a scholarship to come to Cambridge?
No, but I believe that when I was born, the first thing my father did was to enter my name in Trinity Hall, the college. And as a second thought, he inquired after his wife and baby. he was devoted to the hall.
So were you the first family member to go to Trinity Hall?
Oh, no, no. My grandfather was at Trinity Hall and my father was there.
Fascinating.
And my daughter has been there. So
there was a long tradition.
Oh, very long tradition.
So when you came across, you came on your own?
Well, I came with my father.
With your father, initially?
Yes. That's in 1939.
Did he go back after that?
Yes, he went back.
He just came and brought you?
That's right.
Yes, by ship?
In those days, yes, by ship. And partly overland, by ship to Marseille, and then over France to England.
So when you came, the sort of war clouds were gathering.
Very much so, yes. So I think it was inevitable then.
Was there an ominous sense as you made the journey that maybe, you know, your boat might be attacked, or it was perhaps too early at that point?
No, it was too early at that date. But we knew that war was coming,
yes.
But quite when it would come, we just didn't know.
No. So you obviously, I mean, you had a very happy childhood in Ceylon. Do you have any, before we move to the time when you arrived in Cambridge, do you have any specific recollections of your childhood?
No, it as you say, a very happy childhood. And for a long time I was the only child. You see, my mother died when I was 17 days old. But I think the world's most marvellous stepmother. She really was, absolutely super. No, I can't remember anything outstanding or special about the childhood, except that it was a very happy childhood.
And when you arrived in Cambridge, yes, as a young, impressionable man at the age of 18...
That's right.
Did you find that it was a big change from living in, from life in Ceylon?
No, because I think the life in Ceylon was more or less modelled on the English style, so it was no change, great change, as far as I was concerned.
You basically must have come to Southampton first, or to Liverpool?
No. We came to Marseille in the south of France, and then travelled overland France, and crossed the Channel.
Gosh, it sounds so exciting.
Well, it's all very new.
Yes.
And I was thrilled to come. I'd been looking forward to it for years. Still, there you are.
That was planned for you right from the beginning.
That's
as,
right.
As a young boy.
That's right.
You knew this would be your future.
Mm.
So, when you arrived in Cambridge, the war had not yet been declared. Is
not
that right?
Not yet declared. No. We landed in England, I think, in the August. And, of course, war was declared in about a month's time after that.
About a month.
Mm.
Do you remember how it felt when that happened, when the declaration was made?
Well, I can tell you almost exactly. I remember vividly. We heard the news while my father and I were still in the street. I don't know what we were doing there, but perhaps we were there. And then we heard that... we were at war, because we knew from the previous evening's news that an ultimatum had been given to Germany and that this would now expire the following morning, which it did.
And your father was still with you? He hadn't
gone back yet? Yes, he was.
So you were in the streets of Cambridge?
Not in Cambridge, but in London.
In London?
Yes.
So yes. It must have been quite a sombre moment.
Very sombre moment.
Yes.
We're not quite sure what to expect.
No. And he still had to go back.
He had to go back. That's right. He travelled back, I think, sometime October or November.
And you would only have known that he had arrived by letter, really, when he wrote to you.
Or cable. Yes.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
So, life for you as a young student began at Downing College?
Not Downing.
At
Trinity Hall. Yes.
And do you have any recollections of Trinity Hall in those early days?
Only that it still seemed to be a carryover from the peacetime Cambridge. Rationing hadn't really begun to bite and all the rest of it. So the first year was really a sort of continuation of the old peacetime Cambridge and Trinity Hall.
Much the same.
Much the same, yes.
So in the second year, did the student numbers drop?
They did, yes. I think the reason is that practically every Cambridge college, in fact, not practically, every Cambridge college had given over half its buildings to the Royal Air Force. So we had the RAF quartered in Trinity Hall as in other colleges.
So did you eat with them in the college?
No. They had their own time for meals, and we had our own times. And although I think as far as the undergraduates were concerned, we were all very willing and anxious to make friends with the servicemen. But I think it was the service that said no. This is service life for them. We don't want too much fraternizing. We did fraternize on the sports field, playing rugby occasionally and soccer.
Yes.
But apart from that, there was very little contact.
Quite formal.
Very formal.
So, did you notice in the second year that there were changes? Did rationing set in? Changes in the college to the way? Was there a difference as the war progressed?
Well, yes. The rationing, of course, got tighter and tighter. But apart from that, one adapted to the slowly changing lifestyle.
And you just did the best you could.
Indeed, yes.
Yes, yes. But there were fewer students and fewer lecturers.
That is true. Quite a number of the lecturers had been called up or went into the services. Fewer students, of course.
So do you recall roughly how many students there were in your class?
I can't recall that offhand. But since all the colleges attended lectures together and so on and so forth, it seemed quite a full house.
But yes, yes. But certainly nothing like the numbers that you have today, where you have about 250 in the first year.
Nothing like that, no.
Did your lectures take place in quite a formal atmosphere? Did you wear gowns?
Oh, yes, always. And we had to wear gowns after dark in the streets.
So was there much... After, obviously, you had your lectures, you had to do your studying. Was there much socializing?
I find that very difficult to answer because I have no experience of what it was like before the war. But such as there was, I should have thought there was a good deal of socializing between the colleges. And in the college itself, yes.
What form did that take?
Chiefly, I think, over tea time. Because with the rationing, it was very difficult to organize dinner parties and things like that.
Yes.
But... And of course one did meet members of other colleges in lectures and after lectures and of course in the sports field.
So that was quite an important form of social recreation.
Oh indeed, yes.
So we come now to some of your lecturers in this period, 1939 to 42, when you did your law degree, and I wonder if we can look or talk about some of the professors. Professor Buckland is the first one that springs to mind. Was he one of your lecturers?
Very much so. In fact, in my final year, I took a very special subject which nobody had taken for years, and I used to go to Professor Buckland every week to his house and receive instruction from him firsthand at his house.
How delightful.
Yes.
Was this in Cranmer Road?
Was it Cranmer Road, Professor Buckland? May have been, I've forgotten now.
And what subject was this?
Well, Roman law.
Which was his...
Which was he? He was the world authority in the subject.
Had you any experience of Roman law before you came to Cambridge?
No, no.
Because you'd been a schoolboy.
That's right. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And was he a nice man, Professor Buckland? He was, of course, very highly regarded. Was he
Oh, Holmes, he was tremendously regarded, but he was also a very peppery and I suppose rather a frightening figure. He was a tiny little man, but
very forthright.
Very forthright, yes. But one had the greatest admiration for him.
It must have been quite an experience to be the sole student. I mean, you had to be well prepared.
Yes, I know. yes. Yes. He was a person who didn't suffer fools gladly, and one had to be very careful to come thoroughly prepared and so on and so forth. But underneath all that, he was very kind and very helpful.
Dedicated.
Oh, very much, yes.
Someone else who taught you was Sir Hirsch Lauterpacht.
Yes.
Any recollections of him?
Yes, he was a remarkable lecturer. I've never seen him with any notes in his hand. Gosh. He used to lecture, as it were, out of his head, and never at a loss for a word or phrase, and his lectures were remarkably good. Wonderful.
Fascinating.
Yes, that was great.
So you really felt you learned something?
Oh, very much so.
Did you have supervisions with him as well? Or
oh, no. He was a professor, and professors didn't supervise.
No. Did you ever have occasion to meet his son?
Ellie Lauterpacht. Oh, yes, very much. Ellie was, he was a junior to me as an undergraduate, and he went to Trinity. Yes, I had quite a few dealings with Ellie, yes.
So I'll ask you more about him when we come to your colleagues at Cambridge, when you became a lecturer.
I see, all right.
Professor Winfield?
Yes. I'm very, very fond of Winfield. Of course, he was at John's. I didn't sort of socialize, if I may use that word, with him very much. But nevertheless, we used to enjoy his lectures very much indeed.
Were those lectures on Tort?
Tort, yes.
And of course, you later edited the work.
Oh, yes.
On Tort, which I will return to when we talk about your work. So you must have, at an early stage, been inspired by him, because you later excelled in the law of Tort.
Oh, yes. Yes. Percy Winfield was, I think, a very prominent figure in my sort of life. And also, he had a very dry sense of humour, which it was very pleasing, I must say.
The Yule Professor, McNair, must have given you lectures in international law, perhaps?
No, it was Professor Lauterpacht who did the lecturing in international law. I was never lectured to by McNair, but I did get to know him.
At that stage, he wasn't perhaps doing international law?
No, I don't think. No, he was not lecturing then.
So, do you have any recollections of him?
Of McNair?
Yes.
Not as vivid as I have of the people who actually did lecture and whom I came into contact with.
Professor Hazeltine, perhaps?
No, Hazeltine, no. Do you know, the only recollection I have of Hazeltine was that when war broke out, Hazeltine went round shaking people by the hand and said, "We'll see this through together, old boy." And as soon as France collapsed, he whistled off to America. Never saw him again.
It's wonderful. Oh dear. And Professor Cuttridge?
Oh yes. He was, yes, marvellous. And he was a wonderful cook.
Was he?
Oh yes, rather.
Did he invite you for meals? Or
No, again, you see, rationing constrained us all.
Yes.
No, I haven't actually been entertained by him in that way.
But that was something he liked to do.
Oh, yes. He was a wonderful cook.
He was a great friend of Professor Lipstein.
Yes.
He paid him from his own pocket. That's when he didn't get his lectureship at Trinity. Professor Lipstein was in an awkward situation.
And well, I know he was at Trinity first.
Yes. And Professor Guttridge came to his aid.
Well, I'm not a bit surprised he was like that.
Very good person.
Oh, yes.
Did he lecture you?
Guttridge? Yes, not very extensively, but I did attend some courses of his lectures.
Was that comparative law?
Yes, I suppose, in a way, yes.
And then Harry Holland at that stage was a reader, and perhaps you were taught by him?
Lectured to by him, yes. A very formidable and very frightening figure, but again, very kind underneath all that. Yes.
His wife lived in a separate house, as I understand.
That's right, I think immediately after they got married. The rumour was that they then went to their respective establishments and stayed there for the rest of their lives.
Professor Lipstein describes him as a typical Yorkshireman.
Oh, I wouldn't like to comment on that. I wouldn't know what a typical Yorkshireman is.
Some of the lecturers that lectured you include Wade, Sir Emlyn Wade.
Well, he was a professor, yes. Now, Emlyn Wade, he knew my father very well when my father was up here, and he too was an extremely kind man. And, formidable in a way, but nevertheless kind.
And the Regius Professor of Civil Law was
Buckland.
Who succeeded him later, at the time I'm talking, you're right, it was Buckland then, but the lecturer, Duff.
Yes, Patrick Duff, yes.
Later became the Professor
That's
of Civil
right.
Law.
Yes.
Did he teach you Roman law?
Yes, he did. He did lecture.
Do you have any recollections of him?
Not very many, because I didn't come across him all that much. But
he wasn't quite as eminent as Buckland.
No, not as eminent. He didn't do very much. He didn't write an awful lot. He wrote one textbook, but that's about all. And he didn't write any articles either, so he didn't really. Consumed an awful lot.
That wasn't that prolific?
No.
No. Somebody called Mr. Barnes. Do you remember him?
Oh, Henry Barnes, yes. He was at Jesus. He was a lecturer in criminal law. Our own supervisor, excuse me, in Trinity Hall, warned us against going to Mr. Barnes. After a couple of lectures from Mr. Barnes, I gave up. The point was that the law department of London University had been evacuated to Cambridge, and Mr. Seaborn Davis was the lecturer in criminal law to London University. So all the people of my college attended Seaborn Davis's lectures and not Henry Barnes's lectures.
Interesting. No other recollections of him?
Of Henry Barnes?
Yes.
He was very fond of the bottle, I must say. But no, it didn't come to me very much.
Dr. Ellis Lewis.
Ah, yes. He was a fellow of my college, Trinity Hall, and he was my supervisor in my second and third years. Oh, yes, I remember Ellis Lewis very well indeed.
A very nice man?
Hmm?
He was a very nice man?
Very nice man.
He was also the librarian for a number of years of the
Squire Law Library. Yes. That's right, yes.
And Bailey?
Yes. He was at St. John's. Again, I was not actually supervised by him, but I was lectured to by him. And his wife was an international lawn tennis player.
Oh.
So I used to have tennis games with her quite a lot. Yes.
Sounds very nice.
Oh, yes, yes.
He later became a professor, Mr. Hampson. Do you remember him during
very
this
well
time
indeed,
when you were a
yes.
student?
Well, of course, Hampson was taken prisoner of war, and he only came back to Cambridge after the war was over. And again, I got to know Hampson very well indeed.
So when we come to your time as a lecturer at Cambridge, perhaps we can hear more about your recollections.
Of Jack Hampson?
Of Hampson.
Yes.
Mm. Lovely. Mr. Jackson, any recollection of him?
Oh, yes. Well, he was my supervisor during my first year. He was at St. John's. A very good lecturer. But apart from that, I don't know that I had very much to do with him.
Someone else that was around when you were a student was Mr. Wally Tooker.
Oh, Wally Tooker of Downing.
Yes.
Yes, he supervised me during my first year. No, I haven't got any outstanding recollections of him. Except that he was quite a character in his quiet way.
So your fellow students at that stage would have been perhaps René David, or would he have been a bit older than you?
Oh, older.
Older.
I don't think I ever met him.
Ah.
So
and
know.
David Daub?
Oh, David Dauber. Oh, yes. Yes, he lectured to me quite a bit, and in my final year I used to go to him, to his house, for instructions. He didn't lecture in the law school, but since I was the only student doing that particular subject, I used to go and take instruction from him at his home.
Very interesting. And what subject was that?
Roman law.
Roman law.
Mm.
I've read that he had quite a sense of humour.
David Dauber?
Yes.
Yes, I wouldn't say outstandingly so, but a very gentle man, yes.
He went across and had a good career in America.
Mm.
And he in fact lived to quite a ripe old age.
Well, I believe he did, yes.
Yes. So do you remember at that stage Professor Lipstein, when you were a student? He would have been doing his he would have finished his PhD.
Oh, he'd finished his PhD, but then he was interned for the first part of the war. And I got to know Lipstein in the middle of the war, when he was released from his internment. And And I got to know him better and better as years went by. Yes. Very fond of Lichtenstein.
Yes.
He died a very short while ago.
It was, seemed to us all very sudden, even though he was 97.
I know.
We still were didn't expect him to die somehow. So we were... Well, this takes us up to the war. You joined up in 1942, and until 1946 you served as a rear gunner.
Yes.
Why in the Coastal Command? How did that come about?
Well, I don't think the choice lay with me or any individual. When I joined the RAF, we were drafted into Coastal Command.
I see. And where did you fly?
From where? Well, it was the very northeast of Scotland. Kinloss, Dalcross, Lossiemouth, and Wick on the northern arm of the Moray Firth. We were covering the North Sea, submarines, and coastal reconnaissance down the Scandinavian coast, Dutch and Belgian coasts.
Fascinating. For 3 years you were...
Yes.
Yes. So, you must have sometimes been quite uncomfortable.
I don't recollect being uncomfortable. No.
You were sort of not... you were in a plane, basically, for most of the time.
Yes.
The service.
Yes, yes, indeed.
But do you remember the conditions? How many of you were there in the plane?
We were what we call a Leelite squadron. The Leelite was a half-million candle power searchlight fixed to the underside of the plane, and we had to home onto the submarine by radar and in the last mile or so switch on the Leelite. And if we'd done our drill properly, the submarine would then be in the centre of the beam, and then we drop our depth charges visually. So,
So, it does sound to me like quite an experience, you know, quite a change from your life at Cambridge.
Oh, very much so, yes.
But you seem to have taken it all in your stride.
Oh, I confess I enjoyed every minute of it.
Wonderful.
It's not a very nice thing to say, perhaps, of wartime activities, but still there you are.
The contrast between writing your jurisprudence book, your jurisprudence textbook, to being a rear gunner is, to me, quite interesting. I wonder whether you were thinking jurisprudential thoughts as you were flying.
I don't recollect any. Just as well, perhaps.
So, you returned after the war to... You went to London, you became a barrister.
Well, as a matter of fact, I took my bar exams while I was still in the services. But after I was demobilised, I came back to Trinity Hall. I didn't go to London.
Immediately. Did you go to London when you became a barrister?
No, not really.
So you were never actually... You didn't actually spend time in London in the aftermath of the war?
No.
Did you practice...
No.
You didn't practice as a barrister? No.
No.
You were appointed then to a position at Aberystwyth in 1941.
1949.
And you were there until 1951.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What made you go to Aberystwyth?
Well, there was at that time no opening in Cambridge, and I don't know who it was. I think it was perhaps Harry Holland or Ellis Lewis or someone, who got in touch with the professor at Aberystwyth, Professor Llewellyn Davies, who had a vacancy on his staff. And he offered me a lectureship through the University at Aberystwyth. And I went there.
Did you enjoy your time there?
Enormously.
Must have been quite a different sort of place to Cambridge.
Oh, very different. I don't know what it's like now. I haven't been back to Aberystwyth for years and years. But it really was a very enjoyable place. Out of the wave.
Yes, very but, remote.
Oh, very, very. Yes. That made it all the friendlier, you yes. know, in there.
I can imagine. So, who were the most influential people on you during that time?
Well,
most influential characters that you met when you were at Aberystwyth?
Oh, well, the professor, Professor Llewellyn Davies. In fact, it was a small law department, and we all worked together.
Well, we've covered the period from your early life in Ceylon up to and including your time at Aberystwyth. Next time, perhaps we can cover your time at Cambridge University and your work.
You mean as a student at university? Or?
As a lecturer.
Oh, as a lecturer, as a right,
lecturer.
Yes.
That would be from about 1951 to 1985.
I see, yes, indeed.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Dyer.
Not at all.
Extremely interesting. Thank you.
Nothing spectacular.
All very interesting.